Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Welcome back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Kyle Devin. And Kyle, it's been about 10 days since the Premier Lacrosse League announced its formation formally. There's been a tremendous amount of content on InsideLacrosse.com and elsewhere. Last Wednesday, we talked to co-founder Paul Rabel on Thursday or Friday. I'm losing track of the days. You posted a story talking about what this means for the landscape, but we have yet to hear your reaction to the announcement. And I'm just really curious, what was your read on the landscape when PL formally came into being?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you're not the first person to ask me, and I think it's been a little bit of a panic, right? Like, I think that's the best way to describe it. And honestly, that was my reaction, is I panicked, but not for the reasons you might assume. I panicked because I generally push forward most of our pro content in the summer. And to me, this is double the work now. You know, I think that was the first reaction. And the second reaction was, wow, they're on TV. And then I think one thing in the article that a lot of people aren't talking about, that I don't think people knew before my particular piece came out, is that Rabel and another group of investors, presumably most of the people that are involved with PLL now, tried to buy the MLL months ago and just couldn't come to an agreement.
And that news certainly changed the perception of the story.
It should. That's crazy. That's the craziest fact I think that's come out, because now all the MLL people can be like, well, wait, why didn't you sell the league? Why didn't you do that? I don't know. I don't have the answers, but I'm pretty sure they were close, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't one time that they went to the league with one offer. You know, I think it was the other way around. It was just, you know, the MLL saying no, which they're entitled to do. I understand that. I think that the reaction from the MLL to the PLL has not been great.
Go on.
You want me to go on? Yeah. Putting up all sorts of releases, pretending like you're not reacting to it, and puffing your chest out as you do it. I think the line everyone keeps, you know, hinging on it and hanging on is the, well, our owners, the ML owners, are worth $9 billion. Well, if you were worth $9 billion, why were you paying players less than a grand a game to play? Why were you doing that? If you're going to go out there and brag about it in a press release responding to a new league that has a better TV deal than you have ever had, I think you need something stronger than that, or at least something that makes sense and is analogous to your goals. That is neither. So I think that's the one thing that people are like, what? Wait, what? Why would you, even if it's true, which assumedly it is because it's in the release, why would you say that? Because now you're just saying that, like, oh, we'll be fine because we have all these owners. You might not. I don't think that's the case, you know?
So one of the things that I have been following most closely is the way in which the audience, particularly lacrosse fans, has reacted to the notion of a tour-based model, and the way in which it's broken the traditional paradigm of a city and franchise-based model. And my sense is that as more and more comments from PLL have come out about why this seems like the better alternative right now, more and more fans, and I think it starts with the most sophisticated, the ones who follow it most closely, have started to come around on the concept. Whereas, you know, originally it was a source of doubt, primarily because of the perception of the LXM Pro Tour, which I think is viewed as a failure, fairly or unfairly. You wrote about why this isn't LXM 2.0, so maybe you can go into that a little bit. But the question I have for you is, do you agree that fans are warming to the idea of a tour-based model?
I think that was the biggest sticking point. And once that it's been explained, and it wasn't just me that explained it, but PLL is not LXM. You know, there's far more money behind it. There's far more reputable organizational structures. in PLL than I think we even know yet or has been made public yet. And that's really the main difference for me. And also, like, listen, PLL took everyone. LXM took 15 guys, 10 guys that mattered at the time that were huge draws. And PLL's talent roster is much larger. I think the touring model, people that are already in cities with MLL teams are still, I get the feeling that they're not sold at all on PLL because they can just go see, you know, I think someone, a fan tweeted at me, I can just go throw down, you know, like $150 for season tickets and go see the Bayhawks, you know, 7 times. And I don't want to go see one, you know, 3 teams that I don't know play once. And that's a fair point. If you're in an MLL market, I can see why PLL doesn't particularly, you know, appeal to you. That's a fair point. I think that the PLL itself, the traveling model also, it's not, I'll be honest, I don't think it's really proven for team sports. You know, I wrote about this in my piece, and actually the PLL is part of their retweet of the pieces. They listed, you know, all the sports that I listed that are kind of travel-y tour model sports, and all of them are individual sports, you know, surfing, golf, tennis, NASCAR, all popular in their own way, just like lacrosse is popular in its own way. But lacrosse is not proven as a traveling team sport yet. I think that if it were going to happen, it would happen this way with the best talent available and a great TV deal, which I think is a huge part of the PLL announcement.
First, well, you said 3 things I want to react to. First of all, I agree with the TV deal being a big part of the announcement. And then my quick point on that is I actually don't think that lacrosse fans have reacted with enough, like, oh my goodness, this is really impressive and this is really meaningful for the sport at large. The volume of games that are going to be on television next summer is going to feel like a lot. And I think that that's gone under noticed. The second reaction that I have is to your point about the way that this will impact MLL fans, existing MLL fans in the league more broadly at large. And that's to say, this is kind of my prediction for 2019. I don't really see PLL undercutting MLL attendance at games in a meaningful way. And then the third thing I'll say is the third point I'll react to, and it's a question, is I have my own opinion on how important players are to fan affinity and attendance. But I want to hear from you. How important do you think this player pool announcement is for PLL? And there are a lot of different reasons that it could be varying degrees of importance. So please include, like, the reason, you know, in addition to how important it actually is.
I think one of the things you look at is you go team by team, right? And we're going to do that later this week. Joe Keegan, Chris Rosenthal, and I are going to go through how the exodus has impacted each team in the MLL. And there are teams that were not as affected. You know, I would say that Chesapeake did everything they could to retain all their guys, and they have a lot of starters returning. I think that there are teams like Atlanta that did the same thing. And I think there are teams like Florida and, you know, Dallas and New York that were absolutely decimated by the player movement to PLL. I think how those teams handle it, that transition has a big impact on the future of the MLL. And I think the problem is that every team in the MLL has a different level of infrastructure and PR and also marketing. They're all different. You can tell me I'm wrong. You're not. I am right. Trust me. They all have different budgets, all of that stuff. We're not even going to talk about the league office. I'm talking team by team. Team by team, it's, you know, they're in damage control. I think every team is a little paranoid about losing more guys. And I think that's crazy. There's already like 140 guys gone. If the PLL is going to focus on anything before their league starts, it's going to be luring college players as soon as they graduate to come play PLL. That's where, if you're an MLL person, GM, working for a team, anything like that, you're in the front office, You need to have a plan about how you're going to get rookies to play for you instead of PLL. That's all I would be thinking about. This whole the MLO secret supplemental draft, I think, is, can we call it that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's a degree to which it feels a little bit unfair, only insofar as, like, ultimately it became not secret, but that was a function of the pressure applied.
Well, yeah, and also I got the list, so that's how it happened.
Yeah,
but, and it wasn't going to get released. I mean, if they were going to release it, they were going to wait. And honestly, I didn't see the point in waiting, so I pulled some strings and got the list. That, like, the fact that I had to do that as someone covering the league as long as I've done it, and at you know, for Inside Lacrosse to get it, why? Why was it hard to do that? Why was it cloak and dagger to do that? I don't know. I think there's just so many mistakes being made on the MLL side by the front office and by teams. Because, I mean, listen, I asked about the subdraft to every coach whose number I have. And they all were, like, really weird and cagey with me. And none of them were just like, I can't tell you. That's all you had to say. You know, so I don't know if that is permeating throughout the league or what. Not just talking to me. I'm just saying that attitude of caginess is permeating throughout the league because they're worried about PLL. Because on the face of it, they put out all these releases like they're not worried. Like, methinks thou protest too much. You know what I mean? Like, you have to separate what is truthful from what you're presenting. And I think one of the things the PLL already has as an advantage is they're already better at doing that than the MLL has been for 15 years. That is huge.
Before we move on along that point, because you and I have debated this in the past, and it's not directly related to the question that I asked, and I want to come back to the point, or the question that I asked, because I do think it's a valid one. So I'll just lay out my opinion, and you can react to it. I think that there's a meaningful but not large number of players who can sway attendance because primarily of the size of their social media platform or the quality of engagement that they have had in certain communities by coaching, whether it be high school or club or clinics. And so when those people come to a market, and I'm going to put the number at somewhere between 10 and 20, the fact that they're there makes a difference because it increases the awareness of the game. But beyond that, I don't think that your typical MLL attendee chooses to go to, say, you know, so I would love to see research on how many, you know, so for the fan that attends an MLL game at some point over the course of the season, what is the average number of games that they attend? And I would argue or bet that, you know, the fans who attend somewhere between 3 and 4 games over the course of the season do so not because of who the visiting team is or who the players are on the field as much as the I mean, primarily it's going to be the availability in their calendar. Secondly, it's going to be a quality promotion that exists alongside the game itself. And I think that that will continue to persist for MLL into the future, even without, you know, almost all of those 10 to 20 players that make a meaningful difference when they do come to town. And that's the basis for my comment about whether or not MLL attendance will be affected by the player transition. I think your point is well taken in the sense that not all teams were affected equally by the creation of PLL in terms of the composition of their roster and their ability to be competitive. And I do think that's interesting relative to, do winning teams equal better attendances in some of the markets that were negatively affected by the creation of PLL? Florida, for example. I don't think that if the Florida Launch were to go undefeated, their attendance would be that much better at the end of the season than it was at the beginning of the season. So I'm interested in that, and I'm interested to follow that. Now, to the point about how they react, I think that those franchises have a pretty heavy burden of reacting nimbly, because if they don't do so effectively, the competitive balance of the league is going to be really disrupted, and it's going to take a couple years to bring the gap between the, or close the gap between the haves and the have-nots, or I should say, the ones who lost a lot of players than the ones who didn't. So I think in that sense, you know, it'll be really interesting to continue to follow. I do think there's more opportunity for the rosters that lost a lot to backfill with really high-quality talent that will take lacrosse fans by surprise. But I also think that they're going to have an uphill battle relative to the continuity and the quality of coaching that they receive and everything else that goes along those lines. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is how much the quality of talent in the player pool affects PLL. And I think the primary function so far is all about credibility. The fact that so many good players have chosen to join this entity goes a really long way toward establishing the entity's credibility in the eyes of the lacrosse community. Beyond that, I think it's too early to tell how much it's going to affect the quality of the product on the field relative to if they had gotten an overall quality of player pool that's, say, 20% reduced. Because I'm just not sure that the type of fan that they're trying to reach is savvy enough to understand the difference, right? Particularly because if they got that 10 to 20 players that I referred to that actually move the needle as far as attendance, those are also the guys that, on a disproportionate basis, are creating the highlights. And I think those are the types of things that matter more in terms of fans remembering the on-field product when they attend an event.
Right, but there's two parts of that, right? So the first part is what you're talking about, which is creating the kind of the experience of it, right? And then there's the part of actually being a fan of the team. And the best example I can give for that is if you were a Cannons fan for like the last 10 years and you were going to rank like plays and all that stuff, there's one play that stands above all other plays. And it happened, I think it happened like 10 years ago, actually. I think it was like 2008, 2009. And it's the Johnny Christmas, Tommy Zummo game winner play, where Johnny Christmas got a turnover near the 2-point line on the other side of the field and hawked it to Tom Zummo, who somehow outran everyone, caught it and scored, and Boston won the game. It was one of the greatest plays I've ever seen in lacrosse. Very few people saw it because it's MLL. But if you're a Cannons fan, that's iconic.
Let me quickly jump in with four other plays that in Cannons lore that stand out in my memory. One, the Brody Merrill full field goal.
Right.
Two,
yeah,
the Mike Powell dive. Three, the Mike Powell hitting a cheerleader with a shot. And four, Rabel and Casey Powell at the end of the championship game.
I would say Chaz, because that's where Chaz did his best dives with the Cannons.
Yeah, but that's the problem. You said dives. There isn't one that stands out.
The first one, the one that's the photo that everyone, and Mike Watson. I'm going way back though. Like I'm going way too far back in the lore. I think that's well taken. And MLL fans of specific teams will have those moments, you know, prized for their team, right? And I think the problem is how many teams have been around as long as the Cannons that haven't moved around as much. You know, there aren't that many. I'm sure every Denver Outlaws fan remembers, you know, the first time they got to the championship and lost, you know, and then the first time they won. It's a huge part of what PLL has to build versus what MLL has. You know, I mean, let's flip the coin over. MLL has the advantage in that they already have super fans. The PLL doesn't even have teams yet. You know what I mean? Like, there's no teams. As we speak, we, as an Inside Lacrosse staff, are doing a PLL draft while we're podcasting, because that's what is the most pertinent. Is like, we need to know who they're around the team. So we were like, let's make our own. Let's have fun with it. You know, and I think that's one thing that PLL is going to do better, because I guarantee you, PLL, when we put this up, right, PLL will retweet it. PLL will publicize it. When we do stuff for the MLL, they don't care. They don't care. And it's not just us. They don't care about anything. They only do their own stuff and put it on their own channels. And the only interaction that we have as media people is with teams and coaches. And that's a choice they've made. And that's their choice to make. But PLL is already doing a better job of that. And that's worrying. But again, I want to go back to the point that MLL does have advantages here. You know, there are MLL groups that are fans that are lifelong fans that raise their kids to be fans. It's taken a while, but it happens. You know, there are kids that growing up in, you know, South Boston that, you know, want to be a Cannons player. They don't know how much the guys make. They don't care about all the politics of that. They just go to the games. They get to meet the players. They have great engagement with the players. And that's something that they can build towards. You know, I think there's, if you're talking about all the stuff that the MLL does right, that's one of the things they do right. It's build fans at the insular lacrosse level. I don't think they're very good at outside fans, which is something that the PLL seems to already be good at, judging by how many shows and like sports programs they've already been on.
So quickly, you know, we gotta start to wind down here. One of the things you mentioned, we're working through this PLL draft. The I believe it's been said publicly, but it's certainly been said privately, that the league is not going to do a draft. And if, you know, to whatever degree they do, you know, pursue that as far as a player distribution, it will not be made public. So they are instead pursuing strategies of roster composition that are based on a number of different factors. What do you hope to see from anything, from branding, name, marks, coaches, clusters of players? Like, is there anything that you're hopeful for that you see from this PLL team composition phase?
So my first and foremost, most primary concern, make sure the teams are even. Make sure you're not building a super team. Make sure there isn't a team that's really bad. Because if you have that, that's not going to look great. You know, I think that there has to be a competitive element at the forefront. I don't care about the themes. I don't care about the logos, the jerseys. I don't care. I should care. I don't. All I care about is good lacrosse, which is what the PLL should care about too. And I'm sure they do. I'm sure they're putting a lot of thought into that, because otherwise they would have made the teams and come out with the teams with the players, right? I mean, they're still assembling, you know, coaches and GMs from what I understand. So to me, the number one thing is make sure these teams are even. And I think that, you know, as we've seen in our draft, it's not that hard to do it, but every team, you know, there's six of us in this draft. Every team has a weakness. You know, there are teams that we're doing that have themes. You know, obviously Joe Keegan's in our draft and he has a very defensive team because Joe's very defensive oriented. I have a transition heavy team because I love goals. You know, it's, and then, you know, Abern's just taking Maryland guys. So there's a lot of ways that you can look at the breakdown of the teams, but the most important aspect of the breakdown of the teams is that they're competitive and even. And that's probably the hardest job they have in terms of constructing a team. I'm actually curious. One thing I'm curious about that we don't know yet, I want to know how many times they're going to practice once they're in season, or if they're going to be a preseason or whatever. I would like to know that it's going to be better than MLL, where it's one practice and a shoot around before a game. If they're practicing three times a week, we might see the best lacrosse that's ever been played.
One of the things about being, I would be concerned about it being too even. I don't want the rosters to be artificially super balanced. You know what I mean? I do. And I also think that one of the reasons that we haven't heard anything about team composition is because they are, you know, Paul's been vocal in terms of, you know, creating six independent groups of a front office person and coaching staff, three or four member coaching staff. And it's going to be incumbent on those folks to make sure that these teams are even. But Kyle, I got to wind up. We got to move on to what's next. So real quick, one more thing I want to get to. We got 1 minute. Can you just, you know, we've heard that an existential question around this entity was the availability of MLS venues in major metropolitan markets. So with that knowledge, can you guess 2, 3, 4, 5 venues that you expect PLL to play in when their schedule is finally announced?
Yeah, I think they're going to play, yeah, obviously, in Denver. And I think that's huge. Probably like Sports Authority Field. I would think, obviously, Baltimore. I don't know where they're going to play in Baltimore or Baltimore area. I would think maybe they might trend towards the DC United, their new stadium for MLS. And it's been said, obviously, that they're targeting kind of MLS stadium sizes. So those would be my two primary ones. And obviously, you know, I'm a New England guy, so I want to see them play in Boston. But I don't want to see them play at Gillette. I'm good. I've been to Gillette a lot. I'll tell you one place I want them to see. I want to see them. I want to see them play at Fenway. I will be the first person there if they play at Fenway. I will push people out of the way. I don't care if you have a baby in your arms. I am in front of you. I'm the first person in that stadium. I want to see that so badly. I think it would be so amazing for the local group of lacrosse people to go see a game at Fenway where, you know, you're raised here to be a Red Sox fan. By the way, congratulations to the Red Sox. World Series champs.
That seems like the perfect way to end this podcast.
Let's do it.
Kyle, as always, we appreciate you joining us on the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Make sure to follow him on Twitter at @TheKyleDevitt. I am at @Terrence1RFoy. It's not the whole thing. It's just Terrence Foy, but you only spell Terrence with one R. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever else it is that you listen to your podcasts. Tell a friend about us, and we will be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse podcasts.
Inside Lacrosse podcasts, the source of the sport.